I can see the dismay written all over Jamie's features. It said they were looking for a house swap, that they needed to be near the hospital as their daughter was undergoing life-saving surgery. He gave his phone number, I spoke to him, he was from the north, like me. D.S. Ben smiles to himself as though he's party to a joke no one else can understand. And that's when I realise. There's no proof that the person we spoke to was Philip Hayward. I sit down with a sigh. Look, I begin, trying to remain calm as I reiterate the facts. I spoke to a man on the phone. He said he was called Philip Hayward. I googled him. He seemed respectable. He came to get the key from my neighbour upstairs. You can check with her. Her name's Evelyn Goodwin. And a woman was seen here too. A glass was left with a lipstick mark on. I cursed myself for washing it and not keeping it as proof, but I'd had no reason to think I'd need to. They had been here. I can hear my voice rising in desperation. And they do own the hideaway because I looked it up before we went, just to be sure. He clears his throat. It's true, they do own that property, but they've been at their home in London since the end of February. Neighbours have corroborated their story. The Haywards don't have a daughter. They don't have any children. He takes his glasses off and leans towards me. I don't know who was staying in your flat last week, Mrs. Hall, but it certainly wasn't the Haywards. 18. I half expect D.S. Burns to arrest us, but instead he stands up and stuffs his notebook back into a briefcase, telling us he'll be in touch, as though he's a travelling salesman, not a detective. I'll be back in the next few days to interview your neighbour, he says. We sit at the table in stunned silence after he leaves, unable to take in what we've heard. I can't get my head around the notion that we've been conned, that someone has used Philip and Tara's home to swap with ours. But why? Jamie puts his head in his hands and groans. What have we done? His head shoots up, his eyes narrowed. We let strangers into our home, and we don't even know their real names. They could have done anything while they were here. Rifled through our personal stuff. They could have bank details, credit card numbers. They were obviously in the study. I could tell that my folder had been moved. He throws his arms up into the air. We're fucked. No, we're not. We need to cancel all our cards, check any accounts that have been opened in our name, I say calmly. We've been unlucky, that's all. Lots of people do house swaps. Maybe the Haywards are lying to the police. Have you thought about that? Maybe he has killed his wife and is trying to frame us. He sighs. Why would he even do that? I don't know, I admit. He needs someone to pin the blame on. He takes a deep breath, and I can see he's making an effort to control his frustration. He spreads his hands out in front of him on the table. Okay, here's what we know. Somebody, either the Haywards or someone else, posted a leaflet through our door asking to swap homes. Were we targeted on purpose or did they do a leaflet drop along this road and we were the only ones to buy it? I frown. I don't know. Does it make a difference? Of course it does, Libs. Don't you see? If we were the only ones to receive a leaflet, then they wanted our particular flat. And if that's the case, it's obviously personal. I'm appalled at the thought. I can't get my head around any of this. It don't make sense. Why would somebody want to use our flat? You think they used the Haywards' house to get us out the way? And if it wasn't Philip and Tara, it must be someone they know. Someone who has a key. His eyes light up. Or someone who knew they were away a lot. Maybe they had a key cut without Philip and Tara knowing. Like that Jim. He was really weird following us about. Or that other bloke at Lizard Point. He was definitely acting odd. Or maybe Philip and Tara aren't as innocent in all this as they make out. Maybe their neighbours are covering for them and Philip killed his wife. Or they've both killed someone else. Despite our situation, I smile at Jamie, feeling closer to him than I have since Cornwall. Because he's finally admitting that something is very wrong. He's not dismissing me as paranoid. This is actually happening to us. He smiles back, a little uncertainly. Then he stands up, pushing his chair away in a sudden fit of frustration. We're just going round in circles, aren't we? We are. I have to do something constructive. I can't sit here ruminating any longer. I'm going upstairs to see Evelyn, I say, also standing up. It's only 5:30 p.m. Not too late to go calling. Jamie looks quizzical. Why? Because she handed our key over to the man who called himself Philip Hayward, and I also want to see if she received a leaflet too. I never thought to ask before. He pulls me into his arms. It will be all right. Please don't worry, Libs. I know what you're like. After everything. He trails off. He doesn't have to finish. I know what he's trying to say. It has been a traumatic few months. And now this? He brushes my hair back from my face, and I lean against his chest. I've always felt safe before, wrapped in Jamie's arms, but this time I'm not sure if even Jamie can stop the unease that has settled like dust into every layer of my being. I fear I'll never feel safe again. Evelyn opens the front door cautiously, peering out with round, frightened eyes. When she sees it's me standing there, she visibly relaxes. But even as she ushers me into the hallway, urging me to get out of the rain, she still wears that pinched, worried look on her face. Are you okay? I ask. She nods and waves her hand dismissively. I'm fine, don't worry about me. Just a hint of indigestion. She rubs her floral blouse with a fist to illustrate her point, although that doesn't explain her fearful expression when she opened the door. I follow her into the drawing room and watch as she makes herself comfortable in her usual seat by the window. I sit opposite her. I don't want to worry her, but I fill her in on what the detective told us earlier. So the man who came to get the key, what did he look like? I ask her gently. She has a cup of tea next to her, which she brings to her lips with an unsteady hand. Like I said before, he was mid-30s. He looked a bit older than your Jamie, but not much. I recall the photo of Philip Hayward on Google, his dark hair flecked with grey and neatly combed into a side parting, his trim moustache, the shoulders of a pinstripe suit visible in the shot. He looked to be in his late 40s at least. Did he have dark hair and a moustache? I can barely keep still. My whole body jangles with anticipation like the bracelets on Sylvia's wrists. She frowns, replacing a teacup on the side table carefully. No, definitely not a moustache. She picks up a knitting. It looks like the beginnings of baby booties in a soft lemon wool, and the sight of them fills me with longing. I'd only just begun telling people I was pregnant, before the miscarriage. The 12-week scan had been days away. We've been so excited, Jamie and I, so looking forward to being parents. We had such plans, and the pregnancy had gone well. I'd experienced no side effects, no nausea. I cradle my stomach. There's still a slight bulge. My periods aren't back to normal. My body out of sorts and hormonal. It's only been 5 weeks after all. Evelyn was so kind to me afterwards. She'd been a midwife when she was young, she told me, and had seen it all before. I wonder who she's knitting them for, before my mind snaps back to the thoughts of Philip. Evelyn pauses from her knitting and assesses me, eyebrows raised. It was hard to tell, really, because he was wearing an hat. A hat? Yes, one of those ugly ones you young people like to wear nowadays. She gives a short, sharp laugh. Like a tea cosy. Do you mean a beanie? I manage. Yes, that's it, a beanie. He had one of those on. A woolly, fleecy thing. It's the same man. It has to be the man from Lizard Point, the man who had been watching us on the beach near the hideaway. Who was it and what did he want? Evelyn carries on knitting, the needles clacking. Radio 2's on in the background and Simon Mayo is chatting to a guest. I swallow down my nausea. Did you ever receive a leaflet through the post, asking if you'd do a house swap? She glances up at me over her needles, which are still moving at speed. No, I didn't get anything like that. She stops knitting and looks serious. Do you think this man is responsible for all those strange things that happened to you on holiday? I shake my head. I don't know. I think so. He's obviously not Philip Hayward. I don't know who he is. Like I said before, I didn't get the sense you stayed very long in your flat. That's probably right. After all, he couldn't have been in Bath for very long if he'd followed us down to Cornwall. Long enough to do something, I admit, with a regretful sigh. I just wish I knew what. I stand up to leave. I'd better get back. But please promise me, Evelyn, if you notice anything weird, anyone hanging around our flat, will you let me know? She stands up too. I'm short, but she only reaches my shoulder. There is something. What? What is it? Well, you've noticed men, not always the same man, but different men, lurking around outside. They've not done anything. It's as if they're waiting.
Waiting?
Yeah, I'm not sure what for, but it has frightened me a little bit.
Was that why she'd been so reluctant to open the door earlier?
You know, she says, folding her knitting away and placing it on the side table. I do see some strange things sometimes sitting here all day.
She takes one of my hands. Her skin feels like tissue paper. Thin and fragile.
Please be careful, Libby, my love. You've always been good to me.
Evelyn, you're scaring me now. What strange things did you see? She blinks, as though inwardly debating whether to tell me. And then...
I've also seen a woman hanging around outside.
A woman?
It might be nothing, I'm not sure. It's probably just a coincidence.
She sighs.
Just be careful. Be aware, that's all I'm saying. When you get to my age, you realise there are a lot of strange people out there. People who think nothing of hurting others. And some of them can be the closest person to us.
She smiles, regretfully.
My husband didn't always tell me the truth. I wasted so many years with him. Just make sure you get the truth, Libby, my dear.
As I return to my flat, looking over my shoulder for the shadowy nameless men or the faceless woman that she talked about, I have the distinct, unnerving impression that she'd been trying to warn me about Jamie. 19. As I close the shutters before bed that evening, I see a figure on the other side of the road. It's too dark and too far away to tell if it's a man or a woman, but by their height I think they must be female. Their features are masked by the dull light, but I can make out that they're leaning against the garden wall of the house opposite and smoking a cigarette. Who would be hanging around at this time of night? Is this the woman Evelyn was talking about? When I look again, 10 minutes later, the person has gone. I hardly sleep. Evelyn's words spin around and around in my head, refusing to be dislodged like a wayward sock in a washing machine. Every time a shadow passes across our room and blind, or the sound of a bin clatters in my street, I wake up with a start, my heart pounding, my nightwear clinging to my sweaty skin. What was Evelyn trying to tell me? Was she insinuating that Jamie wasn't to be trusted? Suspicion swells inside me. I so desperately want to think the best of Jamie, but I can't stop the nagging voice in my head telling me that Anya is beautiful. That Jamie's by himself in the house all day and has plenty of opportunity for an affair. That he's cheated before. How would it have started? Had they bumped into each other while he was out walking Ziggy? Most people stop to stroke or coo over our dog. And Jamie is handsome. Friendly. And we've had our problems these past few months. Has Jamie's head been turned by Anya? Had they got talking and then realised their mutual attraction? Did they fall into bed together, unable to stop themselves? My thoughts have run away from me like an excitable toddler. I know, deep down, that Jamie loves me. And he's too disorganised, too moralistic to conduct a double life. But then, Hannah's text message pops into my head. Along with a little voice reminding me that he is keeping something from me. Something Hannah doesn't want me to know. Is Hannah behind the house swap? Did she send me the backpack and the wig? That doesn't make sense. Why would she? And what about the bloody clothing that we found in the Haywoods garden? If it doesn't belong to Tara, then whose was it? on Saturday. I offered to take Ziggy for his morning walk. Jamie pauses from tying the laces on his trainers to look up at me. It's the only exercise I get, he says, sounding disappointed. I sometimes run with him. I'm stuck behind a desk all day. Is that the only reason he's so desperate to go? Or is he hoping to bump into Anya? Let's go together then, I suggest. He seems surprised, but he doesn't object as we amble down the street. In fact, he seems happy to take my hand in his. It's a sunny day, unusually warm for April, and I'm only wearing a thin jacket over a t-shirt and jeans. I purposefully lead him past Anya's house, hoping to spot her. I'm not sure why. Maybe I want to see how Jamie reacts if we bump into her. If he really has sent her romantic cards. If he really does have a schoolboy crush on her, I will know by the way he acts around her. Martin's car's in the driveway. A black, shiny BMW. But there is no sign of either of them, much to my disappointment. I wonder, as we head to the park, whether Martin actually believes his wife has been unfaithful. Maybe she really is having an affair. Maybe there's another Jamie, and he jumped to the wrong conclusions. We spend Easter Sunday with Jamie's family, like we always do. It's times like this that I miss having a family of my own to spend the holidays with. I watch Hannah, noting the many times she tries to engage Jamie in a private conversation. Could she have hired some man to pretend to be Philip Hayward, to drive a wedge between me and Jamie? But that's just too bizarre. Surely she's not capable of that kind of manipulation. I observe her, bustling around Sylvia, helping set the table and placing pretty ditzy napkins on plates. My offers of help were battered away earlier by Sylvia, with a slightly harried expression. I also study Katie, and she flits around the house in her too skimpy clothes, acting like the teenager she still thinks she is, her hair in ropes around her shoulders, a strand woven around one of her fingers. She has a new boyfriend with her, someone else to squeeze in around the oval dining table and for Sylvia to fuss over. He's older, handsome in an obvious kind of way, with two white teeth, dark hair and a square, desperate Dan jaw. His name's Gerard, and they'd met through friends, apparently. He went to Sheffield Uni, didn't you, Gerard? Katie says over the roast duck. Well, you, Libby! Gerard, who's sitting between Katie and Hannah, and opposite me, Florrie and Jamie, grins innately. I certainly did. There's something about him I don't like. He seems too pleased with himself, with his top-of-the-range car and his job in events management. He assesses me, then with his hooded eyes. He resembles a crow. What year did you graduate? I prod a roast potato with my fork. 2008? Ah, 2000 for me. I'm a little older than you. That made him 10 years older than Katie. He looks like the type of man who thinks it's a status symbol to have a younger woman on his arm, as though Katie's a flash motor to brag about. What course did you do? English Lit. My mouth's gone dry. Gerard's too nosy for my liking. Me too. Do you remember Professor Peterson? He were a right one, wasn't he? I'm sure he had narcolepsy, because he seemed to fall asleep as he talked. Either that, or his lectures were so soporific he bored himself. He laughs at his own joke, and I grin along chewing my potato. Katie can't stop stroking his arm and gazing adoringly at him. Richard, who's sitting at the head of the table opposite Sylvia, watches them with interest, over his glass of red wine, as though he hopes they'll start having sex right there and then. Jamie and I had agreed before the meal, not to mention the disturbing developments and our fears about the Haywards to Jamie's family. We still hope there will be a simple explanation for it all. Although, as time goes by, I'm at a loss to know what that could be. Gerard is staring at me expectantly, another question about our university days already forming on his lips. He opens his mouth. And do you remember? I need to change the subject, quickly. I don't want to be engaged in conversation with Gerard any longer. Florrie? I cut right across him, in my best teacher's voice, clear and confident. I really love that top you're wearing. Where did you get it? I returned to school on Tuesday, welcoming some normality, some routine back into our lives. I'm delighted to be teaching again. to interact with my class and to gossip with Kara. I'm so busy over the next few days that I push everything else to the back of my mind, where it sits there, niggling away at me like an ache. I'm tired as I trudge home from work on Friday evening. It's been a busy day. A year one child threw up outside the receptionist's office. A parent came in to complain that her son wasn't being moved up the reading levels quickly enough. And I've had to get to the bottom of why one of the year twos deliberately ripped up a library book in a fit of temper. After so many restless nights, I can hardly think straight. The rain begins to fall as I turn into our street, cementing my bad mood. I see Evelyn sitting in her chair by the window. It's prematurely dark because of the weather, but she doesn't have a lamp on. I wave, but she doesn't wave back. My mind is foggy with tiredness. All I want to do is convince Jamie to get a takeaway and flop in front of the telly to watch the affair. My heart falls when I see D.S. Burns sitting at our kitchen table. He stands when he sees me. He's wearing the same beige Macintosh, and I can see a stain down the front that looks like brown sauce. He has a mug in front of him, the one with the triangular chip at its rim that we should have thrown away years ago. Can't believe Jamie's given it to him. Jamie pushes back his chair, relief on his face. "I've told D.S. Burns everything we know," he says, before I've even sat down. I drop my bag by my chair and shrug off my jacket. The air in the kitchen feels oppressive, with a faint tang of spicy noodles which Jamie must have cooked for his lunch. "Right," I glance at Burns. "Jamie's told you that we think the man at Lizard Point is the same person who pretended to be Philip Hayward."
"Yes, he's filled me in on everything. We're trying to ascertain who may have had a key to the Haywards' property."
"Do you think," I gulp,
"that a murder took place there?" "I can't reveal that at the moment, I'm afraid, Mrs. Hall. Although I can say that the clothing has been examined and it doesn't belong to Mrs. Hayward. The blood isn't human either."
"Not human? You mean it belongs to an animal?"
"Yes. We think it must have been put in the garden to frighten you. We're also trying to discover whether this is something personal against yourself and Mr. Hall, or whether it's a scam."
He clears his throat.
"Have you noticed anything missing from your property? Jewelry or any other items that could be worth something?"
I frown. "No, nothing. It's one of the first things I did when returning from Cornwall. Not that we have much in the way of valuables."
"And you've changed your locks?"
I nod.
"As soon as our upstairs neighbour told me that Philip Hayward, or who we thought was Philip Hayward, hadn't returned the key."
"That's great. I'll be in touch when we have any more information." He inclines his head towards Jamie.
"Thank you, Mr. Hall, for the updated statement. That's very helpful."
I almost expect him to doff his hat at us, if he was wearing one. There is something reassuringly old-fashioned about him. Jamie sees him out, and I switch the kettle on, smiling to myself when I hear Jamie bound into the kitchen.
"Isn't it good news?"
he asks.
"There didn't seem to be any news. He just wanted more information from you, didn't he?"
"Yeah, but I think he believes us. He said he's going to speak to Evelyn and she'll confirm that a man came to pick up the key from her and what he looked like. Honestly, for a while there, Lips, I thought we might get arrested for murder or something."
I laugh, although it sticks in my throat. All I can think about is that someone deliberately soaked a woman's underwear in animal's blood to scare us.
About 20 minutes later, Jamie is ordering a takeaway and I'm pottering in the kitchen, when I hear the sound of knuckles rapping urgently on our front door. I can see from the kitchen window a flash of D.S. Burns' beige coat, the rain falling heavily onto his head and shoulders. I curse under my breath, wondering why he's back again so soon. Maybe Evelyn's revealed something that he needs to ask us about? I shuffle to the door in my two large slippers, my dressing gown wrapped around me. I'd changed out of my suit the minute the detective left. I feel bloated and uncomfortable. I open the door and let him in out of the rain, a gust of cold air in his wake. He stands in the hallway, his eyes narrowed, making them look even smaller behind his thick glasses.
"I'm so sorry to bother you again, Mrs. Hall, but I can't get hold of your neighbour. I've been knocking for ages and I can see her in the window, but she's obviously too scared to answer. I was wondering if you would come with me, Maybe if she sees you, then she'll answer. I know some old people don't like to open the door when it starts getting dark.
I swallow down a sigh and grab my raincoat from its peg, kicking off my slippers and shoving my feet into a pair of wellies. I don't get the chance to tell Jamie where I'm going, as I follow D.S. Burns to Evelyn's door. Most windows along the street are illuminated by the soft glow of lamps or overhead lights. But Evelyn's flat is shrouded in darkness. I can see her in the window. I lean over the railings to tap on the glass, careful not to fall onto the sharp spikes or to lose my balance. I imagine landing with a sickening thud outside our kitchen window. Jamie finding me, prostrate on the pavement outside our front door.
Evelyn, it's only me,
I call, but my voice drifts away into the rush hour traffic building up along the main road.
Who lives above Mrs. Goodwin?
Says D.S. Burns.
Nobody.
I tap the glass again, trying not to lose my footing. It's a two-story house. The basement where we live was converted and sold separately.
Why isn't Evelyn answering me? And why is her head slumped back against the headrest of her favourite chair?
She can barely make the stairs anymore, but she's lived here for more than 40 years. I turn to him, trying to quell the worry lodged heavily in the pit of my stomach.
I think something's wrong. I can't see properly over the railings, but she doesn't look like she's moving. She could be asleep, but she's 80.
Understood. I'm going to have to break in.
What the hell is going on?
Jamie's suddenly standing on the pavement in the rain, watching us.
You disappeared. I was worried.
I fight back tears.
Evelyn's not answering the door, Jane. Can you go and get the spare key?
D.S. Byrne looks relieved not to have to break the door down.
You have a key. Why didn't you say?
You didn't ask. We'd swap keys just in case either of us ever got locked out. Although she doesn't go very far nowadays. I pull the coat around me, shivering. Jamie's back within seconds. He darts up the stairs to join us, turning the key in the lock deftly, their heavy front door swinging open. I run past him, the others close behind. I know before I even enter the room that she's dead. But I rush to her anyway, my insides twisting with grief to see her sitting in her favourite chair. The yellow baby booties she'd been knitting on the floor by her feet. Her beautiful blue eyes staring into nothing. A hand on her chest as though, as death approached, she'd been willing her heart to keep beating.
20.
I spend most of Saturday in bed, crying. Jamie can't understand why I've taken a death so hard. How can he when he's constantly in the bosom of his heaving, loving family? He only knows what it's like to be loved unconditionally. I haven't experienced that type of maternal love in a long time. And it wasn't as though Evelyn loved me. We only knew each other for about 2 years, but I could tell she cared about me. That she was on my side. She was the closest thing I had to a grandmother, and now she's gone. Her last words to me play on a loop in my mind. She'd implied that I shouldn't trust my husband.
Why would she say that?
I think again of those cards Martin accused Jamie of sending to Anya. The secret he shares with Hannah. What had Evelyn been alluding to? I dismiss the thought straight away, feeling disloyal to Jamie for even entertaining the idea. But it keeps creeping back into my head, needling away at me. I've always been so sure that Jamie would never cheat on me, that he takes our marriage vows seriously. He's a black and white kind of guy, no grey areas for him. It can be infuriating sometimes, but that's why I love him. Yet what if I'm wrong? What if I'm one of those women who's blind to what's going on under her nose? Is everything that's happening to us now because of Jamie? What's that saying? Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Who has Jamie scorned? The thought of losing him is so painful it makes me feel sick. He's the only person I have left. He walks into the room, carrying a tray of tea and toast. Would he be so kind to me, I reason, if he was having an affair? Guilt, insists the voice inside my head. Guilt, is why he's bringing you breakfast in bed. I'd read a book only the other week about marriage, where the woman finds out that her husband has a secret life. That he isn't what he'd seemed. It's too common. There are always stories about it in newspapers and magazines, under screaming headlines of love rat or love cheat. And Jamie has kept things from me before. The loan from his mother, for one thing. He doesn't think I know about that, but I overheard them talking in low voices. He'd been unable to set up the business without her help. I still don't understand why he couldn't just tell me. Pride, I suppose. And he knows I'd hate the thought of owing his mother anything. "Are you all right, Libs?" he says now, placing the tray across my lap as though I'm a patient in hospital. He sits on the edge of the bed. "I'm so sorry about Evelyn." A tear snakes out the corner of my eye, and I grab the tissue from beneath my pajama sleeve. After constantly sniffing as a child due to hay fever, my mum always made me carry a tissue. It's a habit I can't break. And in a strange way, it makes me think of her, knowing that she cared about me in her own way. "Thank you for this," I say, indicating the breakfast, the tissue damp and starting to break up between my fingers. He opens his mouth as if to say something, but then closes it again. I know what he's thinking. That this isn't just about Evelyn. It's about losing my mum, too. I sense him contemplating whether to bring up counselling again. I take a sip of tea, assessing him over the rim of my mug. He rubs his eyes. His blonde hair is damp from the rain, and he looks ruggedly handsome in his old primal scream t-shirt and jeans. I yearn to reach over and kiss him, but something stops me. He's smiling at me, but it's too set, too fake. I put the cup down. "What is it? What's wrong?" His smile slips. "It's been a stressful few weeks, and I didn't want to worry you with this," he says, looking down into his lap. It's then that I notice the bank statement in his hand. "But I've spoken to D.S. Burns, and we think it must be the same person who's responsible for opening the catalogue accounts under your name, and all those annoying pamphlets and circulars you keep receiving." I'm angry that he went straight to D.S. Burns instead of talking to me about it first. The tips of my fingers tingle, and I resist the urge to snatch the letter out of his hand. "What does it say?" His voice is strained when he replies. "Our bank account has been emptied, and someone has opened a £4,000 credit card in your name and spent all the money." I fall back onto the pillows, fresh tears forming in my eyes. "Oh, God." I know. Luckily, our account wasn't that flush at the time. They only took £700. "Only? It could have been worse. And the credit card?" "That's a bit more difficult. We're going to have to prove you didn't open it. They add all your details, national insurance number, bank account numbers." I push the tray aside, suddenly losing my appetite, and jump out of bed, pulling my dressing gown on. "Who would do this to us, Jamie? Why go to such lengths?" "Someone seriously fucked up, that's who," says Jamie darkly. "Do you know anyone like that, Libby? Anyone from your past?" I round on him, my cheeks burning. "Do you?" "The bag, Libby. It was a backpack. Could it mean something?" "Why? Why does this have to be something to do with me? This could be about you. A woman who you've scorned, perhaps? There seems to be a few." "Not this again," he mumbles, his face crestfallen. "Why won't you believe me?" My anger vanishes as quickly as it arrived. "I'm sorry," I say, going over to him. "It just doesn't make sense, Jay. None of this makes sense. Has someone organized this whole house swap just so they can get into our flat and rifle through our things to steal enough details to get a credit card in my name? I've read newspaper articles about the elaborate lengths scam artists sometimes go to. But why us? Why not one of the bigger houses down the street? There are many more valuable houses in Bath, like Martin and Anya's, for example. Why choose our small basement flat?" "Unless it was personal." Jamie plants a kiss on my mouth. It feels perfunctory rather than loving. Why do I feel that these events are forcing us apart rather than together? He stands up and stretches his long legs. You've had a shock with Evelyn's death. I'll sort this out. It will be all right. I'm touched by his optimism. It's like having the old Jamie back, the one I'd first met, who had taken a broken, defensive girl with enough baggage for a year's holiday around the world and breathed life back into her as though he were a paramedic. I can't reconcile that Jamie with the one Evelyn warned me about. The one who keeps secrets and tells lies. Who maybe has affairs with a married neighbour. But our personalities are multifaceted, aren't they? Maybe those traits are part of him and I'm only beginning to realise. I can hear him clattering around the kitchen, emptying the dishwasher and putting the crockery and glasses away. Usually he has to be reminded to empty the dishwasher. He obviously wants to keep busy, I tell myself, pushing away any disloyal thoughts that it's guilt galvanising him. I'm popping out, Libs, he calls from the kitchen. I'll be a few hours. See you later. Before I can answer, I hear the front door slam. Where's he going? I rush to the kitchen window and pull aside the blinds, but there's no sign of him. The pavement above empty and slick with rain. Ziggy whines, and I turn to see him lying despondently on the wooden floor, his head between his paws, looking up at me with his big brown eyes. Jamie usually takes Ziggy when he goes out. I crouch down to comfort him. I'll take you for a walk, let me just have a shower, I say, kissing the top of his fluffy head, inhaling his comforting doggy scent. I'm just about to go back into the bedroom when I notice Jamie's laptop on the kitchen table. He usually keeps it in the study. He very rarely works weekends. He's still starting out, so he doesn't have that many clients. In fact, he complained only a few nights ago that he isn't as busy now that two potential clients have pulled out, deciding to go another way. It worried him. I could tell by the creases in his forehead as he told me, trying to appear casual, with his legs stretched out in front of him and his laptop resting on his knees. Yet his voice gave away. It had been tinged with panic, questions of how we would cope financially left unspoken. I don't know what makes me do it. It's something I'd never have considered in the past. Maybe it's what Evelyn said, her last words to me still fresh in my mind. I lift the lid of his laptop. He has a picture of the two of us as his wallpaper. Ziggy squashed between us, our arms around his neck. It was taken last summer, a few weeks before we got married, in his mum's garden. It's the same photo I have on my phone. We both look tanned, my dark fringe swept to the side. A contrast to his dirty blonde mop. Our eyes shining with happiness. Our smiles wide and sappy with love. The top of Ziggy's fluffy head reaching to just under our chins. A lump forms in my throat. I snap the lid shut. What am I thinking? I can't spy on my husband. A knock at the door shatters the silence, and Ziggy leaps to his feet, emitting a deep bark. I go to the door, opening it halfway, conscious that I'm still in my dressing gown. A man is standing in front of me, good-looking, in his early 20s. Yes? I'm looking for a Jamie Hall, he says, in a foreign accent I can't quite place. He's not here at the moment. Can I help? There's something about the man's expression that unnerves me. Cocky, arrogant. His body language, too familiar. He said he would meet me here, but he didn't say anything about a three-way. His eyes travel to my bare legs, as though following an invisible line, stopping where the velour dressing gown meets my calves. What are you talking about? The advert, he says, frowning, suddenly unsure of himself. He lowers his voice. The sex. I close the door in his face, my heart pounding. The sex? In the middle of the afternoon, in broad daylight? You bitch! He shouts through the door. And then there's the sound of his boot kicking the wood. Ziggy begins barking furiously.
If you don't leave right now, I'll call the police!
I scream back, fleeing into the kitchen so that I can watch as he strides up the steps to the pavement above. I see him pause when he reaches the top, and then stroll on as if nothing untoward has happened. Evelyn's words flash through my mind.
I've noticed men, not always the same man, but different men, lurking around outside. It's as if they're waiting.
I open Jamie's laptop and Google his name, already having an idea of what I might find. I have to scroll through numerous Jamie Halls until I find what I'm looking for, and despite my suspicions, my mouth fills with saliva when I click onto the lurid porn site advertising Jamie's services. 21. I pace the flat, unable to settle. I ring Jamie's mobile, but there's no answer. Where the hell is he? I try to keep busy to ward off my unease. I shower, dress and take Ziggy for a walk via Anya and Martin's house. It's a Saturday, but Jamie left in such a hurry this morning that I can't help the flame of suspicion that flickers in my mind. Is there some truth to Martin's accusations? No smoke without fire, right? Is Jamie with Anya at the moment? As I approach their house, I notice Anya in the driveway, pulling dandelions out of the front garden. Martin's car isn't on the drive. Even weeding, she looks glamorous, a scarf tied around her dark hair and wearing skinny jeans that hug and flatter. I hesitate by the entrance. Dare I approach her? As if sensing my presence, she stands up and turns around, her eyes widening when she notices me.
Can I help you?
She asks, walking towards me. Her voice is soft and well modulated, but her eyes are wary. She's wearing gardening gloves with a pretty floral print. I tried to work out her age. She can't be more than 30 at the most, but the way she holds herself, with a kind of self-assurance, reminds me of some of the mothers at school. I can feel myself blushing. I'm Libby, Jamie Hall's wife. Recognition dawns.
Ah, I see.
I actually don't think you do. Could we have a quick chat? She frowns, her gaze taking in Ziggy, as though worried he'll mess up her front lawn. I notice she's wearing red lipstick, which enhances her olive complexion. She reminds me of Nicole Scherzinger.
I don't think there's anything to chat about. Do you?
My husband didn't send you those cards, I exclaim. I don't know why it's so important for me to tell her. Maybe it's pride. I don't want her to think my husband has a crush on her. I don't know why you think he did. A smile plays on her lips.
Maybe because he signed them.
Saying what? Jamie Hall? Don't you think that's a bit weird, including his surname? She looks unconvinced, as if she's used to being sent romantic cards and mementos from lovesick admirers.
Do you even know Jamie?
I blurt out. I wait, my throat dry, for her response. Ziggy pulls on his lead and I pat his head to reassure him. Anya appraises me with coal-rimmed eyes and then shakes her head.
We've never spoken,
she admits, apart from a brief good morning. Relief surges through me, thank God.
But,
she adds,
I've seen him around quite a bit.
He's cute. She watches me for a reaction by charge on.
The thing is, we think we're victims of some type of scam. The police are investigating. We did a house swap. Now things are missing and weird stuff is happening. Jamie didn't send you the cards, but we don't know who did.
I pause, my heart racing.
I just wanted you to know that.
She shrugs.
Fine.
She transfers her secateurs from one hand to the other.
Is that all?
She raises a perfectly groomed eyebrow. They are so perfect, in fact, that they look like they've been tattooed on. Yes.
Thanks.
I mumble.
Good. Nice to meet you,
she says, and then turns on her heels. She's actually wearing heels to gardening, and struts back down her driveway. I've only been back in the flat half an hour before Jamie walks in. He's a streak of dirt on his face, and dark patches on the knees of his jeans. What has he been doing? Where have you been? I rang your mobile, you didn't answer. He can't meet my eye. He snaps the kettle on, and then leans against the counter, playing with his phone. Helping out a friend. Why? Because while you were out, a man turned up here, asking for you. He wanted sex. His head whips up so fast it's actually comical. What? Yes, that's right. He was looking to have sex with you. And then I realise why. I lift the lid of his laptop. The porn site is still on the screen. Jamie rushes towards it, his face ashen. The website is explicit, advertising bisexual Jamie Hall, who is up for anything with either sex, particularly hardcore bondage. In the photo, he looks so young and handsome, in jeans and a white shirt. He must have been about 19. Hannah. The photo would have been taken around the time they'd been going out. Has she done this? I dismiss the thought immediately. Hannah loves Jamie. Why would she do anything so horrendous? I've never seen this website, you know that, don't you? He says, gripping the edge of the table as if to moor himself to the room. Of course I do, I say, shocked that he could think I'd doubt him about this. Where did they get my picture? He shakes his head. I can't believe a guy turned up here. Christ, Libs, anything could have happened to you. He turns to me, his eyes full of fear. It upsets me to see him like this. It's usually me who's afraid. I don't think we should stay here at the moment. I sigh. Ever since that man turned up, I've been thinking the same. I've googled my name and nothing's come up, but that doesn't mean I'm not somewhere on the web offering my services. But where would we go? We can't afford to stay in a hotel, especially now. I think we should move in with my mum. Just for a bit. My heart sinks. Or we could stay in the coach house at the bottom of the garden, I say, liking the idea much more than sharing a house with Sylvia and Katie, regardless of how much space they have. His cheeks colour. Ah, well, Hannah and Felix are staying there at the moment. She couldn't afford the rent on her place anymore, and don't look at me like that, Libby. I swallow down my anger. What? She's been having financial trouble. That's what she didn't want me to tell you. She's embarrassed. Her ex isn't paying child support. She's only got that part-time job in the estate agents. It doesn't pay much. She couldn't keep up the payments on the flat she was renting. And, well, I've been trying to help her. Financially? Jamie, we haven't got enough money ourselves. He sighs. I know that, but I said I'd have a word with Mum, who then offered Hannah the coach house rent-free. That's incredibly generous of Sylvie, but why didn't you tell me? Because I knew you wouldn't like it. Is that your philosophy on our marriage, then? You keep things from me that you know I won't like. What else are you keeping from me? He runs a hand over his face and groans. We can't keep going over this again. We've got more pressing things to worry about. Like this fucking website with my name and our address all over it. Just get it taken down, then, I hiss.
You're in IT.
I'm sure you can find a way. I push my chair back so hard that it crashes to the floor. We both stare at it, in surprise. I'm about to flounce off, but Jamie stands and grabs my arm. Libs, please don't. I burst into tears.
This is a nightmare, Jamie. I feel like we're in a nightmare.
He cradles me to him. I know.
And Evelyn's dead.
I sob into his t-shirt.
I can't believe she's dead.
Then a thought strikes me. I stand back. The neck of his top is wet with my tears.
Is that where you were this morning? Helping Hannah move?
He nods, sheepishly.
So you left me here, crying over Evelyn to go and help Hannah move?
I'm sorry. I promised I didn't know Evelyn was going to die. I was only gone for a few hours. She just needed some help moving the heavier stuff.
And she couldn't get a removal van.
She couldn't afford it.
You should have told me, Jay. I could have helped too. But Hannah wouldn't have wanted that, would she? She wants you all to herself.
He looks shamefaced. I'm such a prat, Libby. I'm so sorry. I should have told you. I don't know why I didn't. I was going to, and then Evelyn died, and you've got enough on your plate. I just thought... I pick the chair up off the floor and sit down on it heavily. I want to hurl abuse at him, but I feel so tired, but all I can do is sink further into my chair. What is the point in arguing about it now? He's right. We have more pressing matters to worry about. Like the website. What are you going to do about this? I say, pointing at the offending page still showing on the screen. He sits down next to me. Somebody must really hate us, Libs, to go to all this trouble. That's what scares me. We decide to move in with Sylvia the next day. I don't relish the idea, but agree with Jamie that it's for the best. Just until this whole nightmare is over. My heart is heavy as I fold some clothes and belongings into a suitcase. The sunshine of yesterday is forgotten, and now rain hammers on the windows outside. Ziggy's turning in circles, desperate for a wee. I don't fancy taking him out in this, says Jamie, watching the downpour out of our bedroom window. Another bloody April shower. Just take him into Evelyn's garden, I suggest. It's visible from our window. She'd offered in the past for us to take Ziggy out there, but we didn't like to. It didn't feel right, somehow. Even though it's an eyesore, overgrown with weeds and bushes. Do you think Evelyn would mind? Tears spring into my eyes. I can't get used to the fact that she's no longer upstairs, sitting in her favourite chair, knitting. I pull the tissue from my sleeve and shake my head, my throat restricted by tears. I'll take him quickly before he pisses on the carpet, says Jamie, with a rueful smile. He calls the dog, and I hear the clink of the lead as he snaps it onto Ziggy's collar and the front door opening and closing. I fold clothes, wondering how long we'll be away for when I hear Ziggy bark. I glance up. I can see them outside, so I knock on the glass and wave. The garden's on our level, which meant Evelyn could only access it from a raised patio area outside a kitchen, or from a side gate at the ground level. It would have made more sense for the garden to have been sold along with the basement flat, but if it had, it would have bumped the price up and then we wouldn't have been able to afford it. What will happen to Evelyn's flat now? And who'll buy it? It won't be the same, having new neighbours, I think, sadly, as I watch Ziggy bound across the wet lawn. Jamie's standing with his back to me, his hood pulled up. He's wearing his green parka that makes him look like a student. We need a garden. I touch my stomach. My periods are so irregular that I don't dare hope I might be pregnant. But the nausea, the heightened sense of smell, makes me determined to do a test to find out. Should we consider putting the flat on the market? With Evelyn's place up for sale, someone might buy the whole building and turn it back into a house. If we moved further out of Bath, we might be able to afford a small house with a garden for the same price we could get for the flat. It would mean a longer commute in the morning, unless I move schools. Either way, it would be a fresh start and a garden for Ziggy and... possibly a baby. It's something to think about. I'm startled by a cry coming from outside. It's Jamie, an edge of panic to his voice. I rush to the window. He's standing towards the end of the garden now, a lone figure, the weeds brushing his knees. He's bending over, as though winded. Ziggy's by his side staring down at something. What's wrong with Jamie? Is he ill again? I run into the hallway, push my feet into my wellies and charge around the side of the building and into the garden, the rain immediately soaking my long-sleeved t-shirt so that it clings to my body. Jamie! He stands up, waving his arms. Don't come over here! Stay there! He shouts in alarm. I don't listen to him, of course. Oh, how I wish I'd listened. I wade through the wet foliage to join him, and there, sprawled out amongst the weeds, is a body. It's almost concealed by the long wet grass, but I can make out that it's a man. His blotchy face staring up at the colourless sky. His eyes open, unblinking. His head is bare, showing a wound to his temple, his short, dark hair matted with blood. Even though his top is soiled with mud, I can tell it's a fleece. A hand flies to my mouth, and I grab Jamie's arm as my legs collapse beneath me. 22. Jamie and I sit on Sylvia's overstuffed sofa, unable to speak, gripping the mugs of tea that she'd thrust into our hands the minute we arrived. The only sounds to be heard are the ticking of the large grandfather clock and the wind that rattles the leaded windows. Hannah's on the other sofa, next to Sylvia and Katie. Their eyes are round with horror as they stare at us. It's almost funny to see their identical expressions, their slack jaws, arched eyebrows and bloodless pallor. The duck-egg blue walls are oddly calming, as is the hypnotic ticking of the clock. I've eventually stopped trembling, and now I just feel numb. Ziggy slumped across my feet like a furry pair of slippers.
"Do they know who this man is?"
says Sylvia, eventually getting up to draw the curtains. "Not yet," replies Jamie. Both their voices sound far away, as though coming from the next room.
"And I'm assuming they don't know how long he's been there?"
I feel Jamie shrug. I tilt forward to put my mug down on the glass coffee table, my limbs so heavy that even this small act is a huge effort. "I think I'll go to bed," I say, getting to my feet unsteadily. Ziggy jumps up and follows me, as I'm relieved to get away from the oppressive atmosphere. I can sense their eyes on me as I leave the room. Sylvia's voice floats after me in a loud whisper.
"Poor thing. She's still in shock. 2 dead bodies in 2 days. It's going to take her a while to get over this."
The spare room smells musty and has an unused air, although it's neat and tidy, with a white-painted dressing table in the corner and pale green flowered curtains at the windows. I crawl in between the crisp white sheets, still fully clothed. I'm freezing and feel as though I'm coming down with flu. It isn't even 9 o'clock, but I can't face anyone. I just want to shut my eyes and fall into a deep, oblivious sleep where I don't keep seeing Evelyn's face, serene in death, or the man's bulging, colourless eyes, the gash to the side of his head. Jamie and I had been frozen for the first few minutes, unable to do anything except stare at the dead man, oblivious to the rain that soaked through our clothes, or Ziggy standing quietly next to us. I half expected the man to jump up and tell us this was a sick joke. But of course he hadn't. The air had been strangely still and quiet. Even the rain was soundless, as if the world was holding its breath, waiting to see what we would do next. Jamie was the first to act, pulling the phone from his pocket and calling the police. Within 10 minutes, 2 detectives had turned up. Then it took hours to explain to them all that had happened. We had to keep repeating every detail, the leaflet, the house swap, how we thought the dead man was the same person at Lizard Point and the hideaway, and everything that had happened since we came home. Jamie kept telling them to speak to D.S. Burns from Devon and Cornwall Police. "He knows everything," he insisted.
"I'll call him," said one of the policemen, D.C. Gardner, who was young, cocky, and very unhelpful.
He'd taken one look at the suitcase on my bed and decided that we were some modern-day Bonnie and Clyde about to do a moonlight flit. Eventually, after speaking to Burns on the phone, they allowed us to go to Sylvia's, but not before making sure they knew exactly where they could get hold of us. I'd been relieved to leave the flat. As we drove away in the mini, I glanced back once at the building where we'd been so happy, where Evelyn had lived for over 40 years, and which now looked dark and forlorn, police tape fluttering in the wind. Days pass. Jamie works from Sylvia's conservatory, and I'm relieved to return to school, despite Sylvia insisting I should take a few days off, that I'm still recovering from the shock. But I need to throw myself back into work, to keep my mind off everything that's happened. I sense Sylvia eyeing me disapprovingly every time I move, and I know she's disappointed that I'm not processing my grief and fears, that I'm just burying them instead. On the Wednesday, I'm called into the